please the court, counsel. My name is Bob Nicholson. I represent JAS Partners, which is the largest creditor in the Fort Wayne Telsat bankruptcy estate.
I know it's probably not pertinent to anything, but what made JAS a creditor? What was it furnishing to Fort Wayne Telsat?
Loans.
Okay, so it just had loan money.
Loans, and there was some preferred stock. And over the course of time, JAS Partners actually purchased a number of other creditors' claims. And ultimately, the JAS claims are somewhere in the range of $5 to $6 million.
Okay, thank you.
Well, if you're a regular watcher of the Antiques Roadshow, you know it's fairly common to see an item.
You'll have to speak up. I can't hear you.
I'm sorry, Judge. If you're a regular watcher of the Antiques Roadshow, you know it's fairly common to see an item that's purchased at a yard sale for an insignificant amount, and then it's appraised, and everyone's surprised at how much. And one has to wonder about the seller. How would you feel if the painting that you sold for $100 and you're watching the Antiques Roadshow one night and it's appraised for $4,100? And you say, well, it's hard for me to feel cheated because the buyer was under no obligation to tell you what it was worth, and you're simply faced with the realization that you didn't know what you were selling. Sort of caveat vendor. And the seller bears the risk of not knowing what he's selling. And the buyer's superior knowledge can lead to a windfall.
Well, look, I mean, let's cut through this. And the fact is, if you read the bankruptcy court's opinion, first of all, the bankruptcy court is well aware that what it's supposed to do is not simply take into account what the trustee actually knew, but this is a quote from the opinion, what was known could have been known or should have been known at that point under a standard of reasonable investigation. So I don't think there's actually even any disagreement between you and the bankruptcy court or the other side about that. That's the full investigation that's being evaluated. And in this instance, the trustee is making judgments about how much to invest in this rather odd FCC license, a limited license because of the nonprofit character, a license where the FCC itself has said at the end of the day it doesn't belong to anyone but IU, and a license where key parts of your case turn on somebody's willingness to believe that there's an oral contract out there. So transaction costs can be very high, as I'm sure you know, in litigation. And the trustee makes a call that it would really just dissipate the assets of the estate to pursue these claims, and it's better to look at the reimbursement for the cost aspect of things. Why isn't all that perfectly rational?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. The primary reason is that the creditors are entitled to the trustee's judgment that is based upon all of the information and accurate information.
Well, but here, I understand that point, but I think you don't understand the fact that information isn't free. The trustee has to invest in the gathering of the information that leads to his judgments. And this trustee invested a certain amount, clearly not as much as you think he should have invested. I understand that, and maybe it wasn't enough. We'll see. But he draws the line at a certain amount of investment where he thinks that the likely return to the estate for more investment in information gathering isn't going to be worth it. And you're asking us to say that he drew the wrong line, as I see.
I don't think that's what I'm asking. I think what we're suggesting is that there was additional information, and based on that additional information, it is clear that the information upon which the trustee relied was simply inaccurate.
And I'm not sure I agree with that, though. I don't agree that additional information was available for free. B, I'm not sure it's as conclusive as you seem to think it is in your brief.
Well, if I could, there are two points that I think are very important. Number one, when the trustee evaluated the value of the license, He used this number of $600,000.
But why does the value of the license matter at all if there's no way it belonged to anyone but IU?
Well, the evidence was such that,
I mean,
you may have
a house that's
a
very
our FCC expert suggested, who undertook a much more significant evaluation of the record than the trustee did, and he suggested that it may well be that the record suggests that the license at one point was in the name of PBS.
Why was the bankruptcy court required to believe your FCC expert?
It wasn't required to believe our expert.
Well, you're saying that the bankruptcy court erred by refusing to accept your FCC expert's opinion.
No, I don't. I think what we're suggesting.
You're not? Because if he didn't have to accept your FCC, actually, Mr. Turner, right, opinion, then how can anything be wrong here?
Well, because, you know, if I don't know if you had an opportunity to read the Bighorn decision that was referenced.
You put that everywhere, of course we said.
In our materials. But you know, we're not just disputing perhaps some inferences that the trustee drew from some facts of which he was aware.
How much would it have cost the trustee to conduct the kind of investigation you think he should have done?
Well, it all depends. We paid about $8,000 to our FCC guy. That's what it cost for us to have a complete review of that record. But I think what's really important is what the trustee did.
My question: how much do you think he would have had to spend to conduct a thorough investigation that would determine who is the, you know, whether your company is really the equitable owner of the license or the rights under the license?
Well, you know, there's the investigation of the record itself.
Why don't you answer my question? I'm asking for a dollar figure.
$20,000.
What are the assets of the estate?
There's nothing.
Nothing? Where's the trustee supposed to get the money for the investigation?
Well, JAS would have offered to do it. We're happy to do it. We believe that in this. This asset is the only asset that's going to be available.
Wait a second. If the estate has no assets, why is this a bankruptcy case? Why isn't it just a suit by you against the Indiana University?
Well, we're not the only.
What's the point of having the trustee in this? I don't get it. All right, trustee has no money.
Neither do I.
He can't conduct investigation unless you pay him. So why wasn't this bankruptcy, you know, discharged long ago? The trustee discharged, and you just sue IU.
Be happy to do that. Happy to do that. But to get back to the point, the trustee, you know, this claim.
And why this comes as an appeal from a bankruptcy?
Well, you know, this is the only asset that's ever going to be able to pay a $5 million claim. The trustee's going to settle it for $100,000.
Are there other creditors?
Yes.
There are other creditors.
Sure. How much are we? Maybe 85%.
You're 85%? And what are you owed?
$5 or $6 million. So, you know, the case gets settled for $100,000. JAS basically gets nothing. IU turns around and recovers $4.1 million on a license.
That was for a bunch of licenses, right?
No, that was just for this one. It was $8 million total for all the licenses. It was $4.1 million for this particular license.
But it was IU's license. That's what I can't believe. You know, if it wasn't IU's license and it had been assigned properly, as at one point had been requested to Fort Wayne Telsat or the PBS station or any of those folks, you would have a very different case. But the FCC and the other party to the purported assignment all say, and this is just a fact that has to be ascertained. You think it should have been ascertained in a different way, I understand, but I don't see why on our review the resolution of that fact isn't something that we give deference to.
That it's not the resolution of that fact. Because it may well be that at the end of the day, we lose.
You have interest in a $4.1 million license.
But you know what? That's not true. The trustee decided that he was going to give up his claim to go after this asset based on his conclusion that because it showed at
the FCC. I understand that. And I'm going to say that the bankruptcy. Well, you just told me that maybe he isn't wrong. That if he thought that if a rational person, you know, some hypothetical rational person had looked at this whole business and had said, we think there is a 5% chance of recovering this license for the estate, do you think a responsible trustee would be required to pursue the license?
Maybe not.
Okay, so there's some lower limit. So if it's a 25% chance, maybe yes, or something. But I thought the bankruptcy court thought it wasn't
actually,
that good.
It's actually a little more complicated than that. Because what the creditors are entitled to is a trustee who is making a fully informed decision to settle a case. And when
that's not really realistic, because to become fully informed might cost millions, right?
This is true. This is true. But when we look at it and we say we weren't allowed to conduct complete discovery in this case, and we found the offer for $4.1 million. IU told the trustee they were putting the license out for bid. The trustee never inquired whether there was any response. That's where the $4.1 million came from.
But you're jumping into the story, I think, at a point after that, which the bankruptcy judge thought was dispositive. The bankruptcy judge understood the 4.1, and, you know, good for IU to have a valuable asset, but if it can't be recovered for the estate, it doesn't pertain to this.
But we don't know that. The trustee decided.
I don't understand why you don't agree that this is really all about the odds of getting it for the estate.
Well, you know what? It's not. What the trustee.
You should be saying yes.
Can I just share with you a little bit? You know, in his examination, you know, we asked the trustee, what did you ask your FCC counsel? He asked him whether there had been an approval of the transfer. We said, did you ever ask him whether the FCC had discretion?
No, you have that in your brief. You have that exchange in your brief.
Not to approve it. No. Did you ever seek a legal opinion from your FCC counsel regarding the effect of all of those documents? No. I asked my counsel, was the license ever assigned? He looked at the record. He sent me the record and said it's not assigned. And then in response to the question, did you ever seek an opinion whether the fact that the license show was in IU's name was dispositive of the estate's rights? And he said, no, I made that conclusion myself. All of the FCC experts who testified that was wrong. The fact that it shows at the FCC as being owned by IU, that's fine, but that doesn't mean that PBS, in whose shoes the estate stands.
What relief are you asking?
We're asking that it be remanded for further investigation in light of the information.
The trustee to conduct a further investigation?
Absolutely, and we have offered to the trustee that we will.
Would there be statute of limitations problems?
I don't think so. The case is still pending. I mean, all what we have is we have a litigation matter. Trustee tried to compromise it. If the compromise is not approved, the case simply goes back and continues on the litigation track. And that's all we're asking for.
You're going to reimburse the trustee for all the expenses of his investigation?
We've agreed to take on the expense. I mean, We believe it's a good case. We believe that all the stones have not been unturned, and I appreciate there is an element of reasonableness associated with all of that. But when you have an asset that's worth $4 million, you know, it deserves a little further peek under the hood.
But of course, you couldn't hold it anyway because it's a nonprofit.
No, and there was some testimony about that, but it's possible for it to happen in much the same way that Fort Wayne Telsat was using that license in the first place.
Wait, I'm confused. Is JAS in this business?
Well, the principal of JAS was the president of Fort Wayne Telsat. I mean, they're very tied into
it. So you could have sued IU, right?
Well, the whole issue of IU claiming the license didn't come up until after the bankruptcy. It was sort of after the bankruptcy. Everybody kind of looks around and says, "Oh, wait a second, this thing never properly got transferred to the FCC, even though the last record there was IU's request that it be completed." And then they go, "Oh, these things have increased in value substantially lately. Why don't we now? We need to take that for ourselves." And
well, thank you, Mr. Nicholson.
Thank you.
Gary.
May it please the Court, Mr. Nicholson. My name is Jeremy Gayett. I represent Indiana University and IHETS. And on behalf of Indiana University, IHETS, and all appellees, we disagree fundamentally with JAS's characterization of this case as being analogous to an undereducated seller of a painting, for a couple of reasons. The asset at issue in this case, the license WLX-236, isn't in any way analogous to a painting. A painting has a market value that's the same for whoever holds it. This license, as the court noted a few times, has pretty substantially different values depending on who holds it. This is an EBS license that can only be held by a non-for-profit, thus only a non-for-profit can enjoy the full value of the license.
So could you just clarify something for me? Suppose, just hypothetically, IU wanted to transfer this license to a for-profit entity. Are you telling me that the FCC would just flatly disapprove that transfer because outside of the scope of the license, or is this one of those things where if the holder then licenses it out to some nonprofit, it would be okay? In other words, can you go through a chain?
Yes, Your Honor. The license would have to be assigned to a nonprofit, but that could be in conjunction with a for-profit entity that would be the real party in interest, who would then lease the excess capacity.
Well, that's what IU wanted, right? To lease, to license PBS, which in turn would be allowed to provide excess capacity to license excess capacity to a profit-making company, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. In the late 90s, there was the intention of that arrangement going forward, contingent on FCC approval.
But if I understand you, though, that first step from IU to the next holder, that assignee has to be not-for-profit, and then they peel off the excess capacity.
Well, that's PBS, yeah?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
That's my understanding.
Okay. So would JAS be entitled to get this license?
No, Your Honor. JAS could never hold this license in its own name, nor could the debtor.
The beneficiaries
of somebody
capacity,
else holding the license.
Yes, Your Honor. We don't dispute that the debtor or JAS, if it were entitled to the license, could realize some sort of value through an excess capacity lease arrangement. But I think the record establishes pretty clearly, first, that whatever value that is, it's for a number of reasons going to be substantially less than that $4.1 million figure. And more importantly...
Yeah, but he thinks he can find all the damaging facts for $20,000. Doesn't really matter if it's $4.1 million or...
Well, Your Honor, and that's another point I'd like to address.
Well, that's a side issue. I don't understand why it should be so difficult... Is this the FCC's fault? Why is it so difficult to figure out whether someone has a license? I don't get it.
Your Honor, Mr. Reaney, who is one of Indiana University's counsel,
prescribes the recording or some other formalization of license grants? Do they have to be approved by the FCC? Is that a matter of law?
That is a matter of law, Your Honor. And
recording it? Okay, so it has to be approved, but doesn't that mean it has to be recorded in some fashion? I don't mean in a, you know...
Well, Your Honor...
The but I don't know, you'd think you could just sort of look up somewhere and would say, yeah, you have a license, right?
Your Honor, what all three experts in this case testified to was that...
Experts? Why didn't someone ask the FCC?
We did, and the FCC said that we, Indiana University, owns the license.
No, I don't mean that. Why do you need experts to tell you what the procedure is, what the law requires in the way of the recording or notification or formalization of a license transfer?
On that point, Your Honor, it appears that the FCC employed...
It appears. Doesn't the FCC... Isn't there a rule that you can consult? Can't you ask the FCC? How do I find out whether X has a license?
You ask the FCC, Your Honor, and they give you an official certification telling you who the assignee of the license is. In this case,
Was that done here?
That was done here. And the FCC said that IU is the holder of the license. What JAS is trying to argue is that when you track through the record of applications and public notices, there are some applications that are inconsistent, some public notices that are inconsistent.
Well, did anyone ask the FCC whether this certification process is reliable? Because there's a lot in the briefs to suggest that maybe the FCC has lost track of these licenses, or it's some bureaucratic foul-up, and nobody knows what his rights are.
Your Honor, that's entirely possible, but there's no one other than the FCC that can tell us what the FCC...
It's entirely possible. It's a total screw-up, and no one knows who owns this license. Now, shouldn't that be clarified?
Your Honor, it should, and it was. We asked the FCC, look, there's this mess of a record. Tell us what it means. The trustee did that. And the FCC came back and said, what it means is that IU owns the license. What JAS is asking the court to do is to go look behind the FCC's determination of its own record to try to redetermine that. Whether or not it would be possible for a clever lawyer and the expenditure of lots of time and money to do that is irrelevant to this case. The trustee was not obligated to look past that categorical declaration by the FCC in terms of who owns the license now. What the trustee did do was he did take the next step and say, okay, IU owns it now. Is there any contractual right that PBS has that I, debtor, standing in the shoes of PBS, can enforce? And he looked at the May 17, 2005 letter from PBS to Mr. Simon that says, hey, PBS and IU were trying to get this license assigned, and it didn't work. And he looked at that letter and very reasonably concluded that PBS was calling off that arrangement between IU and PBS. And since he's standing in PBS's shoes, and PBS has now disclaimed any arrangement, the trustee very reasonably concluded that that was a long odds proposition to try to enforce whatever agreement there was. Now, the bankruptcy court gathered even more information than that. The bankruptcy court put Mr. Simon on the stand.
Suppose PBS had said, yes, we did agree to take this license from IU, and, you know, we forgot about it, something like that. We didn't do it. Would that make PBS and through PBS, you know, JAS, somehow the equitable owner of the license? Would the FCC recognize that and say, yeah, you're really the licensee?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that would make PBS the equitable owner of the license. I think based on the testimony of Mr. Ritchie and Mr. Rini that what would have to be done is a new application for assignment would have to be filed, because I think the initial application for assignment was dismissed when an amended application seeking modification was filed. That actually
requested. That was a mistake by the FCC, wasn't it?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. The subsequent...
I understand that. There's no reason why the modification was inconsistent with the license.
Well, the modification requested dismissal of the original application that had requested both assignment and modification. And so the FCC dismissed the original application in its entirety.
But if all you're asking for is modification, I mean, it's so ridiculous. You wouldn't ask to modify something where if you didn't have a license, right?
Well, Your Honor, if your point is that the FCC record is a shameful
mess,
I agree.
No, wait a second. What sense would that make? You ask to modify something, and they treat that as a dismissal of the... as a renunciation of the property that you wanted to that you're asking to be modified. Right? It didn't make any sense.
Your Honor,
I ask, are we talking about two different parts of property? Because I thought that the first application dealt with the license, and then the second one, the next year, was talking about equipment that would need to be modified.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which you might use, I suppose, under some contractual arrangement. Is that possible?
The second application was to modify the equipment that was going to be used to transmit under the license. And under FCC regulations, it's all part of the, it's
all
bound together.
That's a separate set of permissions to modify equipment?
Yes, it's separate from assignment.
Okay. But I don't know why you'd want to modify the equipment if you didn't think you were going to get the license. I will go back to that.
I agree, and I think the record is pretty clear that at this point in time, IU and PBS were still contemplating their original arrangement. It's after this point.
So you think they were going to refile a new assignment request at some later stage?
Speculating on the record, it appears that everybody thought that the assignment was still pending at that point. And to Your Honor's point, I can't defend the FCC record. It's indefensible. All I can do is say that the trustee looked at it, saw that it didn't make sense, asked the FCC what it meant, and the FCC said it means IU owns the license. At that point, the trustee has completed a reasonable investigation. In fact, it's contrary, I think, to the entire purpose of the bankruptcy code and this court's precedence for the trustee to ride hell for leather
The trustee could have decided to, challenge the FCC, but I can see why he wouldn't want to go that far. But that would be the argument, the other side.
Well, Your Honor, and that's, I guess, the alternative analogy I'd like to propose. This case isn't about a painting sold by an ignorant seller. It's about a fourth-grade math proposition. And the proposition is that zero times any number equals zero.
That's as bad as the painting. If this really were worth $4.1 million, it might be. Presumably, I know there are there are review proceedings within the FCC. If someone says no, IU still owns the license. That's not the commissioners. That's some lower level official. You can challenge that in the agency, right?
In this case, it was the commissioner of the FCC who said that IU owns the license.
The commissioner. It's multi-headed.
The chairman?
There's one commissioner.
In the record, the sealed certificate that verifies the owner of the license is signed by the commissioner of the FCC.
What do you mean signed by the commissioner? There are five commissioners.
Well, Your Honor, it's signed by one of them. I'm trying to capture an image of it in my head.
But look, you can imagine a more persistent trustee who would say, look, what's going on here? This is ridiculous. I want the full commission to review it, right? Or I want reconsideration. There are all sorts of. You don't take your first stamped doc certificate from the FCC and treat it as holy writ, right? Now he may have made a judgment that there just wasn't enough money involved, right? That's your point about that it's not. There's no way this could be worth $4.1 million. But that's important. If it were worth $4.1 million. It would be worth, pushing the FCC a little harder.
Well, Your Honor,
once you know they're all screwed up, right? You don't want to treat their certification. You don't want to take it at face value.
Your Honor, I would close by saying that FCC counsel, who testified in this case, all three of them, testified that the certificate the trustee got that said that IU is the present owner was the highest and best answer that it's possible to obtain from the FCC. That it is, in this context, the closest thing they were going to get to Holy Writ. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gayad. Mr. Boyer?
If it please the Court, Mr. Nicholson, I'm David Boyer II. I represent the trustee in bankruptcy in this case.
Are you the trustee?
No, I am not. I'm actually the trustee's younger son, or his son.
Pardon?
I'm his son, Your Honor. And I represent him in this case. As it relates to some of your questions to Mr. Gayet, it wasn't the SEC's mistake as it relates to the application process. It was the counsel performing the application. They essentially just forgot to check a box. And it was basically check all that had applied. And counsel that submitted the modification to the channel just forgot to check that box. And therefore, when they took that modification, it dismissed the other application that came out in the court in the trial.
The FCC always that persnickety? Couldn't they have said, well, obviously this was an oversight and we're not going to pay attention to it?
I think they are that persnickety. They are involved in more information than I knew, a lot of math as it relates to those things. And if the box isn't checked, what they do is they dismiss the former application. And if they don't fill out all the procedures right, the staff doesn't know how to process the application through. As it relates to the trustee knowledge and what the trustee relied on, the trustee did obtain an FCC expert from Washington, D.C. to consult with this and look at the record. Not only did he do an FCC consult with an FCC expert, he also talked to an FCC consultant that was familiar with the market value of the property.
Also, isn't the trustee himself an expert in this kind of license?
Yes, Your Honor. The trustee, actually, through this experience, the estate did sell seven commercial channels for $4.7 million. So the estate did have some assets in it as it relates to that.
Although, and I take it those assets went off to the secured creditors?
Correct, Your Honor. The majority of those assets have been distributed to secured creditors, so we were limited to what we were doing. The trustee, unlike JAS, looks at this through a fiduciary's eyes and looks at the best interest and weighs all these things. So he used the tools within himself as any general litigant would. He had good FCC counsel involved. He used an FCC expert in market value. He had actually seen that the market had declined. He was appointed in 2005, worked through, and took advantage of a peak in the market. There was actually a merger between Fixed Wireless and Sprint that was under SEC scrutiny, and that raised and elevated the prices in October. And he realized and talked to his FCC consultant and understood that the market at the time of the settlement had been going down. And so that was also part of his reason for settlement. As it relates to speaking with the debtor, he had been contentious with Mr. Simon, and the record below is replete with that. But he did check with someone that was involved in the debtor, a Mr. William Millett. Mr. Millett was the chief operating officer of the debtor prior to that, and he suggested to the trustee that the settlement for $100,000 was reasonable. I think the trustee used his best interest and reasonable investigation, and we'd ask that this court affirm the bankruptcy court and the district court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Boyer. Mr. Nicholson, anything further?
Thank you, Judge. Just a couple of things. The trustee did sell a four-channel license for $2.7 million. Okay, and we just heard testify that the price was going down, and yet IU has an offer later for $4.1 million for a four-channel license. Now that's the same license that the trustee, in his deliberations, put his best-case scenario at $600,000. So he was wrong. I mean, he was just simply wrong. You can read the record. IU was sitting there with this $4 million offer in its back pocket. They actually reached out to the trustee's expert, his consultant, to try and get settlement discussions going so that they could, affect this transaction and move on their way. They never disclosed this $4.1 million. The trustee's consultant had no idea what the value of that thing was. They had no idea what anything. And that's the point. That nobody knew. Nobody on the estate side knew what was going on. Just to clarify one other issue here, this May 17, 2005 letter from PBS where they originally disclaimed any interest in this lease or this license, that was after the filing of the bankruptcy. The automatic stay was in effect. Nothing changed. We take a snapshot of what happened there. All this stuff happened after the bankruptcy was filed. That's when everybody decided, oh gosh, look at this. This thing's worth a lot of money. How can we fit this thing into the hole here so that we can take it for ourselves? And beyond that, you know, PBS, for all that it said, it didn't have any rights in it. It assigned its rights to the trustee. The trustee had originally filed.
It's kind of a lawfully assignment. It's sort of a quit claim, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, they're saying they don't have anything, but the trustee moved to assume the lease in the bankruptcy, and the resolution of that was the functional equivalent of this quit claim deed. And then you know, my final point is there is a difference between the owner and the record holder. The document that was paraded around at trial, the certificate that Mr. Gayd referenced, that is a certificate that says who the record holder is. But all of the experts who testified in this case said that record ownership is not dispositive of rights in the license. And that's where the trustee made a mistake. You know, and we're not here to beat up on the trustee, but he made his own conclusion that record ownership was dispositive, and based on that, he gave up his right to what we now know is an extremely valuable asset, and he didn't.
Yeah. So this $4.1 million, this is the Clearwire offer.
Yes, it is.
And could he have discovered it, the trustee?
Absolutely. Absolutely. IU's lawyer sent the trustee a letter and said, hey, I'm going to put this license out for bid. If you want to bid, bid. And the Clearwire offer came in response to that, but the trustee never made any further inquiry. That's all. We obtained that after we filed our objection, and we were limited in discovery to only matters that had occurred during the course of the proceeding.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Nicholson.
Thank you.